Hello there, David. Are you on? Donzella here. And when I first heard about David Reed and this company, for one thing, I have a great title, Ease. I wanted to know a little bit more about them, invited them on the show. So, David Reed, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Don. I appreciate having the opportunity to come here and talk a little bit about ease.
Okay, well, first, Dave, tell us a little bit about yourself, then about your company, and finally, your website.
All right. I am a 56-year-old entrepreneur from Minnesota, came from a small town in St. Paul. I basically early on got introduced in the insurance industry, always revolving around small businesses, working with small businesses and primarily their health benefits. Everything I've done has led up to where we are today, which is a modern version of that. So what is Ease? We're a modern all-in-one solution for small businesses to address their benefits, HR, and payroll needs. And we distribute our product through their typical trusted advisor, which is an insurance broker.
Okay, and your website?
Ease.com, E-A-S-E, Ease.com. Great short name. We didn't get that in the early days. That took a while to, when I was bootstrapping, it wasn't that long ago, and I'll let you drive the questions here. I don't want to dominate this, but there was a day where there was no way we could have had Ease.com. But it's always had the name Ease in it, Enrollees, Ease Central. Something Ease, because the theme of being simple to use is really important in our business model.
Well, you certainly got a great name now. But, you said a mouthful, to help the insurance, HR, et cetera. Exactly what do you offer, and how does it help a small business?
Okay. People are probably familiar with an application like QuickBooks, simple accounting software that allows them to move from filling out checks and bills and registers by hand and putting it on a simple SaaS, software as a service platform, so you no longer load it onto your local computer. It's up on the cloud, and it's all safe, secure, maintained, easy subscription. You pay a flat, affordable rate every month. That's what we do. We provide a software subscription that's typically bought by an insurance broker where they set up their employer accounts, like a small business, a donut shop, a garage, an art store, whatever it is. So the employees of that business basically access their stuff, benefits, HR, onboarding, company policies, request time off. All of that becomes available to them on an easy-to-use cloud software program that was, typically only available to large companies in the past.
But you do it through the broker, so in effect, the broker has a great chance to be almost a partner in the small business, if I'm hearing you correctly.
The broker's not so much. I view the broker as being the trusted advisor. When I look at a software application like this, like I break it down to the day when I was a broker. And this goes back, so I'm 56 years old. So I used to do this the way it was done 25 years ago. And as a broker, if I had an open enrollment that comes every year on my small businesses, and let's just say they had 20 employees, not a big company, and they offer four or five plans, a medical, a dental, a life plan, a flexible benefits plan. And each one of those plans takes two or three different pages to explain what it is and present what the rates are. Well, pretty soon you're making small book coming off your printing presses at the office. So for an employer, a small business, to take all that and stick it on the internet, someone's got to do it. Now, we're a technology company, like I said, that makes that software application. There's still a lot of expertise that brokers bring to the table for smaller businesses, and particularly as rates are starting to go up. The role of the broker is going to be more important than ever because they bring their strategy to the table. Today, what we offer is what the modern broker has to have in their toolbox to efficiently service their customers. It's table stakes.
Couldn't agree with you more. But I guess my question, so the broker comes to, let's say, a paint company that has 12 employees. and acts more or less as the HR department, handles the claims, et cetera. And it's all done through I don't want to say an app, but an online service. Am I hearing you right?
Correct. It is. And it's what it is the way the employer and the employees access all this is the modern way. It's online. But really, the person flying the plane, the person who puts it all together, that's the broker who understands, hey, this paint shop with 12 employees, it's in Toledo, Ohio. That's a very different lay of the land than a small attorney in San Francisco and the plan options that are available and what the funding mechanisms are, meaning like how much money does the employer have to contribute towards employee benefits and what do they have to do to be competitive based on what like employers, that's part of what our survey is about, in order to be competitive, what do you got to do out there? But that role is typically something that a small business who it's just them, it's just that paint shop. They can't really have visibility and do what is available, what are people doing, what are creative options. And it's a very competitive environment when you bring the brokers in that not all brokers are created equal. There's a big competitive environment there in terms of expertise and approaches to how a broker can help an employer reduce their costs.
Absolutely. But you also said just now that you got a survey that you've done that you'd like to share with us.
Sure. Sure. It's the first, this is our first release of the EASE benefits survey. And this is basically our employee insights report for small businesses. To frame this up a little bit, EASE has just over 70,000 small businesses using our platform for their benefits and HR and payroll administration. And these employers have an average employer size of about 29 employees, and over half of these employers are under 10 employees. And I always like to remind people, according to government statistics, 76% of businesses in America have under 10 employees. So we're in where most of the businesses are. And the report gives us some pretty interesting insights, I think. One is that clearly benefits are important to be competitive as an employer, because we're seeing more employees added to benefit plans in the small business pool. But at the same time, we're seeing rates or costs go up significantly from 2017 to 2020, basically that 3-year span. We're looking at a 50% cost increase on families and a 37% cost increase on employee medical rates. And that's a problem. I'll take a breather there.
That's an amazing statistic. I know it's there, and especially when we spent the previous 8 years saying that the costs were going to come down with all of the governmental actions, but actually the costs have gone up, and you're not the only one to say that on this program. That's the point.
Yeah, they have, and it's, you know, if you frame this up a bit here, just to understand the dynamic, if we look at what is the most common thing you're going to see in a small business in America with under, say, 50 employees, it's probably going to be a fully insured medical plan. It's not going to be a self-funded plan. It's going to be fully insured, and it's therefore going to be regulated by the ACA, and I'm not making a normative decision about that. I'm just judgment about that. I'm saying that they've defined what the plans have to cover, what's eligible, what's not eligible, certain things such as that. So the only real way for a business in that space now to lower their costs are to do things like raise the deductible, raise co-pays. So it's a very limited set of options that you have to deal with in that environment. So that's what we're seeing, is in order to lower costs are big increases in deductibles, but that does open areas for employers to offer segmented, voluntary, individualized options for employees to fill those gaps. That's one topic. And then I'm going to take a breather after I just give a segue if we get to it, is we do see a lot of creativity and innovation where brokers are bringing what's typically been large company approaches to benefits to small groups with respect to funding. They're technically self-funded plans, but they work in a way that a small business can have predictable month-to-month expenses and very limited liability exposure, but it allows them to be more proactive in how they design what is and what isn't covered in their plans. And that's the other area where you can have some cost controls. What's covered?
We had one of those plans on our show just recently. Complicated, but more, once it's explained, it's relatively simple, and it's surprising. But let's go on. So you're saying, okay, you've got the survey. Give us some more from the survey that can help our small business listeners.
Okay. One is, I'll make a couple of observations just about the data, and then we can talk about things that might be insightful around it. We do see that cost increases in the Northeast are higher than what they are in the West. And we also see that in the East, there's fewer choices than there are in the West. A small business on average on the West Coast is going to have 6 plan options from which an employee can choose, where on the East Coast, they're going to have typically 1 or 2. So not as many choices based on that. And choice seems to be a big driver, both in terms of the different kinds of plans employees can choose from and across different carriers in some cases. But let's just talk about plan choices. When you have limited plan choices, you don't have the ability to offer the full range of, say, super high deductibles, the high deductible health plans that qualify for health savings accounts, or high deductible plans that lend themselves to a strategy where employees can literally buy gap insurance. And by gap insurance, that means I have a $5,000 deductible. I need to fill that gap. But I don't need to fill it for everything. I only need to fill it for certain things. My kids are saying sports. Well, when you can start buying coverage in a segmented way on a significant portion of the cost driver of a health insurance premium, assuming you go to the very high deductible levels, by combining choice, transparency, and education across your employees, that is a way that a small business can immediately drive down costs versus just trying to buy a $2,000 deductible where everything's carte blanche, everything's baked in, everybody gets everything.
I just want to back up. What did you say about HSAs, which happened to be a really hot topic with me? To me, they're the best thing you can have if you have a high deductible plan, because in the end, you are ending up saving some money.
Correct. The less insurance you buy, the less money you're going to spend on insurance. And the thing about the HSA is it engages the individual to become a consumer in this whole buying process. Whereas if everything is covered under an insurance plan, there is really no incentive to understand that the same service can have a remarkably different cost in the same geographic area because it's through a different provider network that has a different overall contract negotiated with your insurance provider. You know, if none of that is visible to you, you know, you don't know the details, but what I can tell you factually is there's a wide range in costs among services. And when they become visible, the people that are going to pay them with their HSA account balances, they buy like they buy everything else. They weigh out quality and cost, and they make an informed decision. That's one of the fundamental problems with the way healthcare plans are delivered today, is there's not enough visibility to the person who's actually making the decisions, and that's you and me.
Couldn't agree with you more. We've been talking about that for 20 years, we being the information strategists who will own this program, because it's so very important. I'll ask you a question. I don't know if you put it on the survey or not. Are people becoming more consumer minded, in your opinion?
Yes. One, there's a few things that are driving that. One is there's clearly generational differences in the workforce in how people consume information and what their expectations are around plans. By 2025, 75% of the workforce is going to be the millennial generation, which is already the largest segment of the workforce. These aren't the people that are 100% digital, but largely fully digital. Z, which has now entered the workforce right behind them, they are the first pure digital generation. I mean, think about that. We have people entering the workforce who know literally nothing but what it is to be fully connected via everything on the internet. Well, that changes the way you get your stuff. Okay. So we are seeing some big changes in terms of how benefit plans are being offered, decision-making tools being made available within these platforms that identify differences in what the experience should look like for somebody. Like if you're a 23-year-old single person entering the workforce versus somebody who's, mid-later years and spouse, multiple children, your benefit package need that's going to be you're going to be looking at, it's going to be entirely different. What's your 401k balance? What are your retirement goals? What are your health plan needs? Those are very, very different. And what's happening is there's so many choices out there now. And it just gets basically very, very busy. And this is where technology like Ease comes into play, combined with brokers, trusted advisors, who can get a reasonable cross-section of these and assimilate them in a way that today's employee consumes. Another change we see out there, and I'm going to take a breather after this, is that it used to be that the group administrator was really the end buyer, the broker that worked with the group administrator. They made the decisions with the owner of the small business, many times one and the same when you're talking to small biz. And that was the customer. Well, today, the way the workforce has evolved, even in small businesses, this catering to the feedback of making a happy workforce that goes beyond just wages. It's what the workforce looks like, whether it's flex hours, work from home, what HR support tools look like. All of those now are relevant all the way to the employee level. So we're seeing that have an impact on what's happening with the life of a broker, what they have to be familiar with and start offering to their small businesses.
We're talking with David Reed. His company is Ease. Ease.com. Dave, will you spell out Ease for our audience? Because this is radio.
E-A-S-E, Ease.com, as in simple, easy. And there's a reason we have that name. That's a big theme about our product, because when you're dealing with small businesses, they're running small businesses. They're not running all this benefit, HR, payroll stuff. They need something that's easy and it's on their mobile device or right in front of them that works the way they work. And that's what Ease is all about.
Well, one question. Do you deal with retirement? Because one of the things is it doesn't seem that this generation is any more interested in starting to plan for their retirement early than any other generation. Are you finding that, or are you finding other things?
Well, number one, I think that the current younger generation is actually, from our perspective, very wired into what is being offered in terms of retirement benefits, more so, in fact, boldly asking, particularly around expectations of employer matches and rounding off their compensation package. We see a big drive of that being, that's a big thing on the millennial generation, is what they're expecting inside of the workforce. As far as us providing it, it's the same way as far as medical, dental. We provide the technology platform that allows a small business to put all of these together in a nice cohesive place. So, you know, if an employee, for example, has a paycheck and they have a benefit allowance, and then they have a smorgasbord of things to pick, medical plans, dental, life, flexible benefits, contribution to a 401k plan. The ability to have that all calculate on one screen to be very visible and simple to understand. And then importantly for today's generation, to be able to drill into any of these on demand and get whatever level of detail you want. That's what we do. We don't provide the individual products, because if you're in Toledo, Ohio, or if you're in San Francisco, or if you're in Dallas, or if you're in Atlanta, or if you're in New Jersey, and I'm just picking cities off the top of my head, the product choices you have in some cases will be similar. Yeah, there might be major brand name life insurance companies in every one of those markets that are similar, but the health plans will be completely different. third-party administrator at Innovative Options would be different in many cases. There'll be regional payroll vendors in addition to the brand name national vendors that have a strong presence, because one of the things we see in small businesses is they like high touch still. They like people. And that's one of the things that I think is never going to change, which is an opportunity for the brokers who service small businesses who are also small businesses.
Again, we're talking with David Reed. Dave, we have just a few minutes left. What would you like to leave our audience with?
Number one, benefits are as important as wages to the current workforce, and that a dollar in wages is not necessarily the same as a dollar in benefits. We are finding that today's workforce sees a dollar spent on benefits to them is worth more than a dollar in wages. And so that's a trend that we're seeing, where employers are starting to shift compensation packages to where they are more benefit generous, but in a way where employees can pick and choose how they're going to spend those. So choice and flexibility is very important to be a competitive employer in today's market. Second, don't go it alone. You want to have a trusted advisor who understands the lay of the land, that uses modern technology so that their workforce has a contemporary experience in how they manage benefits, payroll, and HR. But it's like when you're going to court, you want a great lawyer. So get a great trusted advisor. In the small group benefits world, there are typically no costs. The insurance carriers have that built into the premium rates the way they're filed, so it's no cost to the employer, and they can pick and choose whichever one they think provides them the best service. And I'd say shop and get a good trusted advisor too.
Got one more? We got one more time for one more.
Mobile. Everything is mobile. Don't underestimate the power of mobile. In fact, in the millennial generation and Generation Z, the majority of the way they access the internet is now through a mobile device. I'm 56 years old. Not only is it hard for me to see even the biggest phones with my glasses on, it's hard for me to manipulate it and things like that, but there's a whole world out there that is completely mobile. So every solution that you're going to provide, you should explore how you can do it in a mobile environment, not just a desktop environment. And I think if you're going to limit your choices to that, you're going to take a lot of choices off the table, but I think that that's one of the important things that should be a basis of making a decision, because that's the way you're going to get to most of your people, by using mobile.
Well, with that note, David Reed, we thank you. Your website again and how people can reach you?
Ease.com, EASE.com. And right through the homepage there, there's a contact us form, so we're not difficult to find.
Thank you so much, Dave. It's really been a pleasure. David, it's really been a pleasure today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure as well.
This is Don Mazzella, and we have with us Sue Iannacone. No, I did that wrong. Sue, we're going to start over again. I should have asked.
it's quite all right. It's Iannone.
Iannone, okay.
Yes.
We're going to start over. 5 seconds. Sue Iannone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So give me 5 seconds of silence.
Mm-hmm.
It's Don Mazzella again, and we have with us Sue Iannone. She is the vice president of CPLP. And if you don't know what it is, believe me, neither did I. But when I heard about the company, we had to have them on the program. Sue, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. It's great to be here.
Well, Sue, first tell us a little bit about your personal background, then a little bit about your company, and finally a website, and we'll go from there.
All right, sounds great. Well, my name is Sue Iannone. I have 29 years in the life sciences industry, which would be pharmaceutical and biotech. My degree is in biology from SUNY Binghamton, and CPLP is Certified Professional in Learning and Performance. So that is sort of my work-related degree, if you will. And I've held roles in sales, sales training, middle management, and learning leadership over the years. I've worked for small, medium, and large companies in both U.S. and global roles. And a good part of my career was being a classroom trainer, working directly with employees to help them learn their jobs or to be able to do their jobs more effectively. I've designed curriculum and built training for over 20 product launches in my career. Led large-scale learning initiatives to help organizations become more effective in meeting their business goals. I've served on the board of directors for L10, which is the Life Sciences Training and Educators Network. It's a network that helps connect like-minded learning professionals in the life sciences industry, and I've taught workshops at their conferences for many years. And then in 2016, I decided to leave the corporate world to start Bull City Blue with my three partners. And we're an end-to-end life sciences learning agency created to address the performance needs of our life sciences clients. But also, Bull City Learning is our parent company that builds digital learning, and our clients span across all industries, and we work very closely together. I live in Mars Plains, New Jersey, so not too far from you. I have two awesome kids who have taught me a lot about learning, and both of my kids have disabilities that make learning really challenging for them. So my son has autism, and my daughter has some communication impairments. I also love to bake cookies, and my first job was working in a bakery, and an early experience there stayed on my mind for many years to come, and it was one of my many reasons for writing this book with my co-author, Carla Torgerson.
Okay. So tell us about the book and how it works and why it is so special, because I know it is.
Well, thank you. The book is entitled What Works in Talent Development, and the subtitle is Designing Microlearning. And I mentioned my co-author, Carla Torgerson. She's the director of instructional design at Bull City Learning. And I work on the Bull City Blue side. And we decided together to co-author this book. It's put out by ATD Press. And Carla actually does a lot of teaching for ATD, which is the Association of Talent and Development. And this is the fourth book in the What Works series. And what's great about the book series, which includes our book on designing microlearning, is that it includes not just some definitions and some theory on the subject matter, but it also includes a lot of practical tools, advice, and case studies that the readers can take and apply to their own work situation. So it doesn't have to be read cover to cover. In fact, we recommend skipping around as needed based on your own experience.
Repeat the book again and where people can get it.
Sure. It's called What Works in Talent Development, Designing Microlearning.
Go ahead.
Our members, please, they can get a discount.
I'm just asking so people can quickly go and find it. Is it on Amazon?
Sure.
What websites? What websites is it on?
Yes, sure. It's also available on Amazon.com and ATD.org.
Okay, I'd like to stop a minute and just ask a question because I'm not into the teaching world like you are. Are you saying, in effect, that microlearning is breaking down tasks into smaller bits and then working that way? Would that be how That's how I would define microlearning.
Well, yes, John, that's actually one way to define it. What's interesting is in the training circles, there's a lot of debate around the definition of microlearning. But through our research, Carl and I, we like to say that microlearning is just enough. It's just enough learning to give your learners or employees exactly what they need at the moment they need it and then get back to their jobs. So, and to make it a little bit more specific, we like to say that microlearning is any learning content that can be consumed in less than 10 minutes. And 10 minutes would be sort of the upper range. So a lot of the microlearning that we've developed is in the 2 to 7 minute range. And the reason we define it that way is because employees and the modern learner, and that would include you and me, Don, we don't have a lot of time to dedicate to learning. Most people want to get right back to work, and they don't want to take the time away from their jobs to be able to do the learning or the training. And certainly not everything can be done in a micro-learning format. You certainly wouldn't want your surgeon who might be doing a procedure on you to go to the, you know, the medical school of micro-learning. But there are a lot of situations where tasks can be broken down into very small pieces, and you can design a piece of learning to address that very specific need for an employee.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I don't know about you, but I can't stand to sit in a classroom anymore. I think a lot older than you, but the idea of going even to a conference today and sitting for 45 minutes listening to someone talk about a subject is very difficult for me, and I think it must be difficult for other people as well.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And when you do go to that conference and you sit there for 45 minutes, if you happen to look around the room, I bet you'll see people checking their phones and being distracted and trying to multitask, because that's just the environment that we live in today. It's very difficult to focus our attention when we have lots of distractions, we have lots of pressures, and a lot of things that compete with our time. So what's interesting about the modern learner is it spans all age demographics. It's not just millennials. It's not just older folks. It's everyone. So why give people anything more than they need to be able to do their job? If it's a job task that can be broken down into a very small part, why not give them exactly what they need and nothing more? And there's a lot of value in keeping things simple for employees. And I can give you an example. It actually goes back to that first job that I had working in a bakery years ago, because it's stuck with me for over 30 years. And it was my first job in school, and I was in high school, and I worked at the local German bakery. And part of my training was to learn about all the different cakes and cookies and the bread that was for sale for customers that came in the door. And there were no menus, there was no signage anywhere that had prices. And so Mrs. Gerst, the owner of the bakery, would walk me up and down the counter with a little piece of paper and a pen, and I would write down all of the prices of the donuts and the cakes and the cheesecakes. And I was allowed to have that piece of paper nearby for about a week. And after that, I wasn't allowed to use it anymore. And while I could remember the most commonly sold items in the store, like jelly donuts or a loaf of bread, it was really difficult for me to remember some of the other items that were for sale in the bakery. And sometimes I would forget. And one day, Mrs. Gerst scolded me for selling a cheesecake at the wrong price. And I cried. I was very upset and embarrassed that I couldn't remember this one piece of information. And I understand why she was upset, because this was her business. But at the end of the day, people don't show up to work wanting to screw up. They really do want to do well. And so how does this relate to microlearning? one simple solution that could have been provided was a job aid with pricing on it. Even if it wasn't visible to the customers, it could have been taped to the back of the counter where I could see it and quickly refer to it, because this was an item that we didn't sell very often, and I just didn't look at it enough to be able to remember. And that experience has stayed with me a really long time, and I keep that in mind when I'm designing micro-learning, either when I was running learning departments back in the industry or even now for clients. We really encourage people to just figure out what is that one task that your employees keep struggling with or they can't remember, or it might be a little bit complex, and in the moment it would be high risk if they didn't get the steps right. Those are perfect examples of micro. You could create a piece of micro-learning. It could be as simple as a poster. To help employees.
That's a great example. We have a local bakery here, Palisades Park Bakery, and they do have a chart at the back, exactly like you said. The reason I know that is because every year when some younger servers graduate from college or high school, they have to train new ones, but the list is always there. It's funny you should mention that. I just happened to notice that the other day.
I was going to say, it's a very simple thing. And it doesn't matter if it's your local bakery shop, which is a really small business, or like some of the larger clients we have. It could be a salesperson that's working out in the field and can't remember how to handle an objection that might come up from customers, and just giving them something to refer to before they go in for a sales call to be able to effectively handle that situation with a customer. I mean, think about, there's the upside of providing them with that. Is they're more confident and knowledgeable and able to communicate in front of their customer. The downside is if you don't provide them with something like that, you could potentially lose revenue because the salesperson was not as skilled or adept in handling that situation.
Well, I guess my other question, I think it does more with the customer service, is how do you deal in a customer service, which oftentimes has unusual instances which sometimes aren't covered? How do you get them up to speed to deal with events that they have not dealt with before?
Yeah, that's a situation we do hear about a lot from clients. And for those, I guess the first thing we would ask is, you can't train everybody on everything the day they start on the job. And if we use the customer service example or like a call center, someone who might be answering the phone, you can put them through the initial, new hire training up front. It might be a day, it could be a week, but you can't possibly train them for every situation. There's two things. One is if you give them the skills to be able to handle the situation. So let's say a customer calls in and they start complaining about a particular product and the customer service person cannot or has not heard this before and they don't know how to answer it. One of the worst things they could do is make something up just to, placate the customer, but that could have, some negative fallout. But you could train them to say, that's a great, I hear your concern, let me get back to you. And it's the follow-up that provides the value. It saves the customer service agent from making a big mistake. That's one way to handle it. And I think generally speaking, that's a great response for any salesperson or customer service agent when they truly don't know. The other is to be able to anticipate what some of these scenarios might be. And if another customer service agent has heard it before and there's some knowledge somewhere, is to capture it and put it at their fingertips. So even if they don't know the answer immediately, if they have the ability to look it up while someone's on the phone, In fact, there's a lot of customer service departments that have those kinds of tools and resources available to their team, so that while you're on the phone with them, they can quickly look it up, find the answer, and solve it without having to say, "I'll get back to you." And we know of a lot of clients that actually operate that way.
Well, Sue, your book again, and where people can get it?
It's called What Works in Talent Development, Designing Microlearning, and it's available on Amazon.com and through ATD Press.
Okay. Well, Sue, again, let's step back. Can you give us a couple of more examples of what you mean by microlearning and how a small business person can apply it within his or her everyday operations?
Sure, absolutely. So microlearning is any short piece of learning that addresses a learner's need. And when we say short, we mean less than 10 minutes. And there's, it can come in a variety of formats. So, for example, we've been talking about like a job aid or a poster. That would be one example. So a text-based resource, which could be just one or two pages. It can come in the form of e-learning, and this would be something you would do online, either on a smartphone, a laptop, or a tablet. It can be video. That's probably the most popular form of microlearning that we see. And anyone who's on social media has probably accessed a video to be able to learn how to do something. In fact, I've often Googled how to fix minor plumbing issues and found short videos to watch to fix like a leaky faucet as an example. And I'll always choose the video that's 2 minutes, not the one that's 25. Another example of microlearning format would be an infographic, and this is where content is graphically displayed with images, and it might have some text, and that could be in the form of a poster as well, or even formats like this, Don, such as a podcast. In fact, we have one client where for busy general managers, we designed a question and answer podcast for their executives to be able to search, and they could just skip to the questions that they wanted to hear the answers to. So each of these mini podcasts were 2 to 8 minutes in length. So those are the five typical formats that we see. And then as far as where might you use microlearning or what are the best places to use it, we have four categories that we find microlearning to be the most helpful. So the first one would be preparing your learners before training or before learning events. So a lot of times in my career, I'd be training new sales representatives that have joined the company. And we would start with a couple of weeks of studying at home, and we would give them, a long time ago, we would give them these big three-ring binders to read about, learning about different like diseases and treatment options for patients. And then they would come in to a classroom for about a week or two for their training. And so you can use microlearning. You can create short formats of things like what are your corporate values? And it could be just a 5-minute introduction to the company on corporate values. Or that. So that would be one example of preparation before a learning event. The second area to use microlearning would be after the live training, so as a follow-up. So companies spend a lot of money training employees. And when you think about the investment they make in that live training program, it would be such a shame for employees to lose all that knowledge once they leave the program. And the way to prevent that loss of knowledge and skill is with, we call it boost learning. So after an employee leaves the training program, you can communicate with them and provide them training in really short clips, again, about 5 minutes, to remind them of some of the most important things that they learned in the program. And the research shows, it's called the forgetting curve, actually. When people leave training, if you don't support them after they leave the training, they will forget up to 90% of what they learned. So So when you translate that into revenue, that's a lot of money that nobody wants to lose. So just by creating short pieces of microlearning, it could even be an email reminder about something they learned. The third way to use microlearning is a standalone training. And this is where you have people on board. They're not new hires. They've been on the job, and something changes or something new happens. Maybe you launch a new product, or you realize that there's a new customer concern that needs to be addressed. You would launch microlearning as a standalone piece of learning. And this is where, as an example, we had one client who, in the device medical device space, you can imagine the medical device and diagnostic equipment oftentimes will come with software that goes along with it. And so technology and cybersecurity is a huge concern of hospitals and other healthcare provider locations where they use this equipment. They want to know if there's a problem or any sort of breach in security. So for this device company, they had a new way for their employees to handle concerns from customers. And so we created a 5-minute e-learning module that explained to employees what they might hear, what they should say in response, and how they should address it moving forward. And it was launched to all employees in the organization. So that's a really good example of standalone. And then the fourth is...
Keep going. You're on a roll.
The fourth and one of my favorites is performance support. And this is where it's kind of like the bakery example, where employees are back on the job. They're trying to do some aspect of their job, but it might be a task that they just don't perform often enough, that they can't remember it. So this is supporting their performance. It could be as simple as a pricing list or recommendations on what to say. It's something quick. One great example of performance support is Google Maps. So how many times have you been in the car and you need to figure out how to get from point A to point B and you've never been there before? So you plug it into Google Maps or you plug it into Waze. And as you're driving your car, you get instant feedback and directions from Google Maps. And that's a great example of performance support.
Your book again for our audience, Sue?
It's What Works in Talent Development, Designing Microlearning. And it's available on Amazon.com or through ATD Press.
Okay, because Sue, you've really certainly opened my eyes. But I'm going to ask you a question. What do you do when you have the people that don't seem to want to listen or learn? How do you get them to at least open up and listen?
Oh, that's a great question, Don. And I wish I had all the answers to that one, but I can tell you what I've tried in the past and what seems to work most often. Sometimes there are employees that don't want to engage, you know, whether it's microlearning or a longer training program. And I found in my experience that there's usually something else that's getting in the way, and it probably has nothing to do with training. It could be something else. They might have a personal reason or a barrier for not wanting to engage in the training. But let's assume that that's not the case. One of the things that's really important when you design any training for any adult, and I'll argue and say that it also applies to kids as well, is you have to explain the WIFM, which is the what's in it for me. And if you can't share with your learners why it's important for them, why would this training be of value to them, they probably won't engage fully. So trying to understand why a learner should participate, what is the value in it to them, you know already that it's of value to the business. But sometimes you have to put it in the context of the learner themselves. And so for a salesperson, the WIFM might be you can increase revenue and earn a bigger bonus check. Or It could be that you're ultimately helping people. So for the industry that I worked in, depending on the different disease states that the sales representatives or account managers supported, for some of these chronic debilitating diseases, by participating in the training, not only are they helping the healthcare providers, but they're also helping patients. So sometimes the WIFM can be different for different individuals. And if you're not sure what that is, I would go ahead and ask them. If you're a really small business, that's a one-to-one conversation. If you're a larger business, it could be doing a survey. And there are lots of free tools out there that you could, like SurveyMonkey, that you could send out to your learner population and just ask them a couple of questions. It's also a great part of a conversation for any manager that has direct reports. And I know when I sat down with my team members over the years, one of my questions was almost always, what motivates you? Is it money? Is it recognition? Is it what you're doing for your trainees? Because a lot of times I had training people reporting to me who were training others. And a lot of people are surprised when they hear that question. It also it makes them feel like you really care about them and that you're interested in helping them to succeed on the job. That was a great question, Don.
But on that note, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time together. So, Sue, one last time, your book and how people can get it.
The book is called What Works in Talent Development, Designing Microlearning, and it's available on Amazon.com or through ATD Press.
Thank you so much. It's been an extremely illuminating time together. Thank you, Sue.
Thanks, Don. Have a great one.
This is Don Mazzella, and we have a really exciting guest right now, Anastasia Kraft. She's here to join us to talk about STEM, which is STEAM, and a lot more. Anastasia, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well,
how are you today?
Well, better now that we got all of our technical problems taken care of.
we have it. It all figured out.
Okay. Anastasia, first, tell us a little bit about yourself personally, then a little bit about your company, and then why you're here, and finally, a website.
Yeah, of course. I was born in Kazakhstan and moved to Germany when I was 10. Loved growing up in Germany. My dad had German roots. That's why my family decided to move. And when I grew up, I decided to go into engineering, STEM, because I always wanted to have a challenging job, having a positive impact in the world, and also have a solid salary that I would not depend on from anyone. So I went into engineering, and a part of it was to go abroad to do an internship. And after applying at many different countries in Asia and South America and Africa, I ended up in Waukesha, Wisconsin, at a very interesting steel cutting tool manufacturer where I did my internship. Fell in love with the Midwest and Milwaukee. Met my husband during that time, and then after a lot of back and forth, decided to move here. So yeah, since then I worked in the manufacturing space. I loved working with my teams. I loved working in the manufacturing environment. Loved doing some project management work. But one issue that I discovered already during my first internship was terrible safety footwear for women. You can imagine that most women constantly transition from an office setting where you might have to present to a group of people or your clients, and then the next minute you run out on the shop floor where you have wear those clunky, terrible boots that were initially designed for men. And I always struggled kind of trying to transition from one space to the other. And after speaking to many other women in the field and my engineering friends, I decided to start a business making more stylish steel-toed boots that have all the safety features but look nice. So, yeah, that's how Xena Workwear was born, and we just launched last year. Very excited about this.
And, okay, your website?
Our website is xenaworkwear.com, and Xena spelled X-E-N-A.
Okay, spell the whole thing out for our audience.
Yeah. N-A, that's Xena, and then WRKWEAR.com.
Okay, so in effect, you're creating clothes to help people, women who are in a field where they're literally dealing on the manufacturing floor, on the production floor. Am I hearing you right?
Yeah, so it's mainly for women who, so it's, the footwear that we make right now is not for someone who is all day in welding or someone who's working on a construction site all day long. Like, there are products out there that fill those needs. I'm talking about women who spend most of their time in an office setting, so engineers, project managers, technical sales, could be someone who is a project manager in a construction site who spends a lot of time in an office, a lot of time in presentations, and then once in a while has to walk through the shop floor. And as soon as you walk out on the shop floor, construction site, you need footwear that has a protective toe cap, that is slip resistant, and in certain cases you need additional certifications. But yeah, that's a niche market. But it looks like there was so much demand. We have women from all over the world contacting us and requesting products. And I think we're by now in 7 different countries.
Wow. So you've identified a need or a desire and are fulfilling it, which is one of the first rules of marketing.
Yeah, exactly. I never planned to go into footwear manufacturing. I always enjoyed engineering and project management. Never planned, first of all, to come to the U.S. And then, yeah, really enjoyed living here in Milwaukee, which is a beautiful city. And somehow ended up making footwear, solving a problem for myself and other women in the field.
So where do you source your products?
Yeah, that was an interesting question. A debate was for my team. We decided to go to Mexico. Ideally, we would have made them here in the U.S., but shoes would have cost between $300 and $400, and people are not willing to pay this much. And then, hold you, someone's picking me up.
Hi.
1 second, please. Will we be able to cut a portion of it out? I'm sorry, I had to, someone pick up 2 packages. Thank you. Sorry. Can we re-record a portion of that?
No, just keep going.
Oh, okay, good.
So,
I'm sorry, someone. This is a part of running a business. I saw a DHL lady come over, and this is international shipment going out to France. Yeah. So, yeah, we've been talking about solving a problem.
So, you're solving your sourcing problem, so you decided to go to Mexico.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because doing it in the United States would make the shoes too expensive. Am I hearing you right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Correct. Yeah, and
okay.
Asia would be, it's very far away, and you lose control over the quality, and Mexico seems to be a very good solution. We're in the same time zone, can jump on a call at least once a week, and if we have to fly down there, it's a 5-hour flight compared to a 14-hour flight to Asia. So we're very happy with our partner in Mexico.
So let me back up a little bit, Anastasia. And so here you are. Are you just creating shoes and stuff like that? Do you also have other other products or just shoes?
So our main focus will be on always on footwear, because that's the biggest pain point for most women who work in STEM, who work in manufacturing, construction, engineering. But since our launch last year, we received so many other requests for clothing as well. So I don't know if you have ever heard the term, it's called shrink it and pink it, which means that companies take a men's boot or a men's jacket, make it smaller and make it pink and sell it as women's. And this is not what professional women want to wear. A pink boot just does not help us feel confident in an office setting presenting to 20 engineers. So we're trying to solve this problem, not only for footwear, but also for other things, including blazers that we plan to launch sometime soon. It's a new project. We don't have an exact date for the launch, but we're working on functional blazers that women can wear in a nice office setting, but also in a dusty, dirty shop floor, like manufacturing environment where you might get dirty. So you can throw them in a washing machine. They will be machine washable, wrinkle resistant, so very nice for travel. And most importantly, they will have multiple pockets for all the PPE we have to carry around. PPE stands for personal protective equipment, like safety glasses, earplugs. It will have a little hook where you can hook in your rings, because in many manufacturing facilities, you're not allowed to wear rings or dangly jewelry, so you'd have to take it off and never know where to put it. So it will have specific features for this environment that will help women transition from one to the other, because right now there are really no good options. In many cases, women are forced to dress down to match their hiking boots. The safety shoes that were available before we launched were hiking boots or tennis shoes, and the only thing that matches them is a hiking jacket. So women were kind of forced to dress down or looked a little bit funny trying to wear something nice with terrible clunky boots. So yeah, we'll be solving one problem at a time, focusing on footwear, and then slowly solving other issues as well.
Well, let's say first on the shoes for now. I'm sorry, we got that was going to be later on, but let's stay on the shoes get back to the shoes. And so, well, how did you come up with the design for the shoes that has made it so popular?
Mm-hmm. So first of all, I had to learn a lot about American safety standards. So I wanted to create something nice, but also be safe. So I had to learn a lot about the features, safety features that it would have to include, the tests and the shoes would have to go through. And knowing those boundaries, I went shopping for a lot of different shoes and kind of selected the ones that would when you design shoes, you assemble multiple features from different designs. You say, okay, I like the zipper this way. I like the main look from this one. So you kind of combine 10 different designs into one, and then you create an actual design on paper and then start prototyping. And your prototype will never end up with exactly the same as your design on paper. So yeah, and I wanted to design something that would be timeless, that wouldn't go out of style in a year, and could be dressed up or down depending on your personal style and the work environment. Some are more professional, some are more casual. So the beauty of this boot, it works in so many environments, and the feeling it gives women, it's just amazing. The amount of positive feedback we get is overwhelming.
Anastasia, your website again before we go any further.
Yeah. It's zenaworkwear.com.
So we just again,
and I can spell
it
again. It's X. Okay, I'll spell it out. It's X E N A W O R K W E A R.com.
I was just spelling it out myself to go to your website and look at your style of shoes, etc. So can I back up? So if I could understand, what you're saying is you were trying to create a shoe that could be used, but be stylish in the office, yet would be comfortable enough and rugged enough for when they had to go on the floor. Am I hearing you right?
Yeah. Yeah, you're exactly right.
Oh. Well, I'm looking at you at your website right now, and how many styles do you have?
Right now we have two different styles. You see three footwear products on the site. So we started with the Gravity Classic that has the most important features. Then the Gravity Plus is the, it has a very similar look to the first one, but has a different composition of materials that makes it static dissipative. And that is something that is used in the chemical industry or in for companies that work with sensitive materials like microchips. So what the shoe does is it conducts your static charge from the body to the ground through the shoe. So that you wouldn't cause a little spark. So you've probably had this experience at some point when you touch a car or a door handle that it causes a little spark. And that spark can be very dangerous when you work with flammable materials or multi-million dollar chips. So you could destroy them very easily. Yeah, that's the C model. And then the latest that we released is the Omega EH steel toe boot. It's electric hazard resistant, so it's it protects you from, let's say, if you step on an open cable, so it protects you from being electrocuted. So there's different types of certifications. We'll be developing footwear one by one to cover most needs based on the feedback that we get.
So I see here that it's slippery. You also have protective steel cap, which I know from my days was very important, airflow, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. Where did you need to wear a steel-toe boot? I'm curious.
Well, construction site. I've been a reporter. You'd be surprised where I've been in my lifetime covering the events where one of the things I was taught early in life, steel capped shoes were a necessity in some of the places I went. So anyway, but I just happened to notice that it's steel capped. Your units are steel. Your shoes are steel capped. It really surprised me.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, that's kind of the most important feature, the protective toe cap. It could have been made from a different material, but in order to withstand the same force as a composite toe cap, it would have to be much smaller. So we decided to go with steel. But always exploring new materials, which is a fun part of this job.
Well, I see the retail price is $160 or $180 in that range, if I saw it correctly. And have quite an impressive list of women who have used who have bought it. How do you market your product?
Yeah, we have our website. Women can find us on Google. So a lot of more and more footwear purchases sales go online, so many people feel very comfortable buying footwear online nowadays. So we have a lot of traffic coming from a Google search. We have we are on Facebook, on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, so people discover us this way. Then we attend many different conferences in the U.S., like women in, there are different groups, women in manufacturing, the Society of Women Engineers, National Association of Women in Construction. So all those groups have been incredibly supportive and held the word. So yeah, we market in different ways, but yeah, digital marketing has been very successful so far. And making, building connections in person. We host events once in a while. We have multiple pop-up events coming up very soon in different cities, so mainly in the Midwest. Milwaukee, Minneapolis, Detroit, and Cleveland. Those are the cities we'll start with. And our customers will actually help us host those events. We have an amazing, amazingly supportive group of women who help us out with this, with those events.
Are you coming to the New York area anytime soon?
We'd love to. Yeah, that would be great, right? That's the fashion hub. That's where we should be. Yeah, we'll make it to New York sometime this summer, hopefully.
Well, you've got to tell me ahead of time because I want to come by and see you. Your shoes look fabulous. Naturally, not
Thank
for me,
you.
But my wife buys all my shoes.
Or know any women in this space? Yeah, I will definitely let you know so you can invite more people.
Well, very definitely. But what would you say is your typical customer? Are they engineers? Are they scientists? Who is your customer?
Yeah, we have many women in engineering who finished an engineering degree and worked, as soon as they started working for a manufacturing company, they realized that they need boots. So age-wise, it's probably between 22 to like 45. It's all across. So many women in engineering, women in many different roles in manufacturing, as long as they work in a manufacturing setting, they probably will need shoes. Many architects who spend most of the day in their nice office, but then once in a while bring their clients on a construction site, lover boots. Project managers who, again, spend a lot of time planning projects, sitting at a desk, communicating via phone. They have to go out on the construction site on a regular basis. So it's a whole range of women, yeah, in engineering, manufacturing, construction. Warehousing is another area, and we keep it expanding more and more. A new area that we discovered was the film industry. I never knew that in the film industry anyone would ever need shoes, but to build those sets and disassemble them again, apparently many women have to or want to wear some protective footwear. So yeah.
So you find new and different industries every seems very interesting. I have so many questions about it, but we have just a couple of minutes left. What would you like to leave our audience with?
Yeah, I would say that we have to work together to encourage more women to go into STEM and inspire more girls to explore the STEM and the trades careers. So yeah, by starting this business, we are solving a small problem in this case. And I would invite everyone else to inspire the girls in their family or friends to explore these professions because they are fun, they are well paid, and you can have a job that brings you a lot of joy and has a purpose.
That's a great way to leave it. Anastasia, your website for one more time?
Yeah, of course. It's xenaworkwear.com. It's xenaworkwear.com.
On that note, Anastasia Kraft, we say thank you for bringing what to me is one of the more exciting guests we've had in a long time. And good luck to you.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to share a little bit about this. This was a great conversation. Thank you so much, Don.
Have a great day.
And I look forward to coming to New York. Thank you.
Please do.
Have
Keep
a good
me
one.
In mind.
Will do. Thank you. Bye.